Good evening, friends. My name's Frank Honeycutt. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
It's good to be here, and I'm happy to know that I'm an alcoholic. I like this meeting. I like the format. I like the people that I've seen. There's a good energy in here. I've walked around and introduced myself to a lot of people, and I haven't smelled anybody drinking yet. I did inquire coming down the freeway. They said that if I came down here, that there would be somebody in here that would be able to tell me where Oceanside is. You know, if you hang around this thing long enough, you get to where you know practically everybody around. And because I have followed your advice and good counsel, I celebrated 30 years of sobriety one day at a time on the 28th day of March. I certainly didn't know that you would follow that clue, but you led me right into this. That applauding an alcoholic for staying sober is just like applauding a rodeo hand with hemorrhoids for not riding a bucking horse. I'm going to have to take some of you on the road with me. This is the best thing that I do. This is the neatest thing that I do. I don't like speaker meetings. And I especially don't like speaker meetings where I'm the speaker. But because I've heard most of this. I wasn't too impressed the first time. And it seemed to have gone downhill from there. But then I like being out. I like touching alcoholics. I like to be able to get out and share my experience, strength, and hope with you. And if you're not happy with your sobriety today, if I were you, I'd start over. There's a line in the big book that says, if you have read this far and you don't agree with it, start over or throw the book away. And I made a comment this morning at a meeting. I get up and go to a meeting every morning at 7 o'clock. I find that it's absolutely amazing how much you can learn after you know everything. And every morning I learn a lot. I go down there with a lot of newcomers. We had 18 newcomers at a 7 o'clock meeting, and that ain't bad. There was 104 people there, and 18 of them were newcomers in less than 30 days. Alcoholics Anonymous is well and flourishing in the Long Beach area. This is healthy down here. This is healthy as can be down here. I see old friends that Clara and Bill back there, and Jack and Joyce and Cliff, and I shouldn't have started because I'll run out. John Skinner and a very dear friend sitting on my one of my best friends sitting on the front row between the guys that rode shotgun with me down here. That's Alan and K. Bob, and then the guy sitting in the middle of them is a very good friend of a baby of mine. He's an awfully good friend. I just forgot his name. He has a difficult name. His name is Smith, Ron Smith. I'll send him a copy of this tape, and then maybe he'll pay me back the $10 he owes me. I was down here about a year and a half ago, and I sincerely like this. I enjoy coming down. And we had a good gab fest on the way down here. And I surround myself with people that are interested in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous, you hear an awful lot of bum dope about the program. at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. They say, well, if you want to find out about Alcoholics Anonymous, go to Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. You will find an awful lot of opinions in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and it's far from being the truth. You will often hear said that Alcoholics Anonymous is not for those people who need it. It's for those people who will do it. And I screwed that up too. You know, at this stage of the game, I think I'd rather be talking than listening. Not for those people who need it, but those people who want it. And that isn't true. That isn't true. That was the untruth that I was trying to get you people straightened out on. Alcoholics Anonymous is for those people who do it. Do it. You see, I needed this thing so badly, and I wanted it so badly, and I couldn't have it. I couldn't have it because, you see, I wasn't doing it. I was attending Alcoholics Anonymous meeting on a daily basis. I was covering a chair every day, and that started on the 17th of August, 1963, and it lasted until the following 28th day of March, and I wanted to stop drinking more than anything in the world, and I couldn't have it. I couldn't have it because I didn't know what surrender was. Alcoholics of my type know nothing about surrender. Didn't know anything about it. And you see, I was the kind of an alcoholic that I knew everything. And if you are like me, and I have met countless thousands that know everything, then we don't take advice very well. We can't even ask a person, how do you do this thing? And by not doing that, then I lived. The only hell that I will ever know was that from the time I darkened the door of this leper colony on the 17th of August, 1963, until the 28th day of March, 1964. I stayed sober for the first 35 days. 35 days is long enough for any non-alcoholic to go without a drink, isn't it? You see, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous under very unique circumstances. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous as a 19th wedding anniversary gift. And I wasn't packaged too well either. I had been out on a safari. I had been out, there's some military people in here, I know. I was absent without leave from home. And when I turned into my driveway on the morning of the 17th of August, 1963, I had that moment of clarity. You hear of the moment of clarity a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous, don't you? I want to tell you what the moment of clarity in the life of an alcoholic is, of my type. A moment of clarity is when that person realizes that you're in deep shit. On that day, I remembered the 17th of August was our wedding anniversary. And it was our 19th wedding anniversary. And all the previous 18 and on every other occasion, we celebrated everything in our house. We celebrated the opening of supermarkets. And when I turned into my house that morning after being on unauthorized absence, I turned into my driveway and I thought, my God, here it is the 17th of August. It is our wedding anniversary. I don't have a card, a bouquet of flowers, a box of candy. I don't even have a bad excuse. But then I took the bit in my teeth and I walked up and rattled the front door. And as I opened the door and walked in, here stood that future member of Al-Anon. You know about it, not knowing whether she wanted to come and hug my neck or get a machete and cut me down to size. You see, this was the dilemma. And then I told her, a question that I hadn't used up until that time, because my football coach had always taught me that the best defense is the best offense is a good defense. So as soon as I would walk into my house ordinarily, regardless of what had happened, it was not my fault. And I was there to tell her it was her fault, or to infer that it might be her fault. This time when I walked in, I didn't say that. I walked in and I told Virginia, I took the other alcoholic out. I told her I was sick. I had been retired from the Navy with a heart condition, and I thought that she would recognize that my heart had been palpitating. That was the reason that I was away from home. And instead of Virginia saying, "Frank, let's get in the car and run up to the Navy hospital," she said, "Frank, would you go to Alcoholics Anonymous?" And you see, I was the smartest man that you've ever seen in my eyes. And would you believe I had never even heard of Alcoholics Anonymous? But then I was trying to, that moment of clarity, you know, I said, "Let's call and make an appointment." We don't make appointments to get here, do we? I called and she asked me if I knew where Morgan Hall was. I was a real estate broker in Long Beach, and real estate brokers know everything. If you don't believe it, ask one. There's a lot of you in here. Then her next question, she said, "Do you have transportation?" I said, "Yes, I have a new Continental." And it didn't impress her any more than it just impressed you. Virginia got in the car and she drove me down to Morgan Hall on Locust Avenue, and as you know, in an old brick 8-story building that was built in 1849 or whatever, and had an elevator that was built 100 years before that. I got into that rickety thing, and we were taking the journey up to the fourth floor, and when I got on the fourth deck, the elevator, the gates opened, and I was walking down this passageway, and I could look around and I could see they really do need a good chief in here to get them straightened out. And when I walked on into to central office, this lady was sitting behind the desk, and they have the kindest people in the world working in central offices. This gal's name was Helen, and she said in a very quiet voice, "May I help you?" And I thought, "Honey, with a voice like that, you can't do nothing for me." And she looked at me just like office managers look at drunks. It was as if I were dressed in cellophane, and I didn't impress nothing about her. She didn't see anything that impressed her at all. She did hand me the buff-colored card that she reached over on her desk, and she got this little buff-colored card, and she said, "Here, you take this test, and you go over and sit down, and you complete this." So I hurried, went over there and sat down, and she immediately started selling Virginia books. Virginia would have bought one of everything. Two of some, she would have even bought the Montgomery Ward catalog. By the time I got back, Virginia had books that she couldn't see over. I took that test very hurriedly, and I didn't read the fine print. So if you're new in here and you haven't taken this fine print, I'm going to save you a terrific amount of embarrassment. I completed that test and gave it to her, and she glanced at that, and she said, "You're sure in the right place." I want to know, how do you know? She hadn't graded a thing, but I hadn't read the keys to the bottom. It says if you have answered yes to one of these 20 questions, you've probably got a problem. And if you've answered yes to two of them, chances are you have a problem. Now then this, I'm going to paraphrase this so you'll fully understand. It says if you answer three or more yeses out of that 20 questions, you're a dead stinking fish. Because it's very explicit. It says, you are an alcoholic. And anybody would rather be a fish than an alcoholic, wouldn't they? And I was lost. I was absolutely lost because the next word Helen said was, you'll be happy to be here because, you see, we just don't drink one day at a time. And one day at a time for me was impossible. Was impossible. The last time that I had gone one day at a time had been years and years. And I know that we get to Alcoholics Anonymous and the first person will tell a lie and the next one tells the next one. And hell, it goes on and on. But it had been years and years since I had gone a day without drinking. I was retired from the Navy the last 5 years, 6 years that I was in the Navy. I was in club management. That was where I was counting the money and counting the whiskey and taking first count on both of them. And then when I retired from the Navy, I went to work in a flaky country club over in Riverside County selling real estate and memberships. And we even worked down some this far. I was selling memberships and desert property in Quail Valley. That's in Riverside County. And if any of you people are unfortunate enough for me to have sold you some, I'm not down here making amends. After being there and for a relatively short period of time, a year or so, I went into the house despondent one day. And another definition of an alcoholic being despondent is when he ain't getting his way. So that I was despondent that way that day, and Virginia met me at the door and said, well, what's wrong? I said, I don't like that job. And she said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I'd like to own a little corner bar. You see, she didn't think it was too funny either. But then we bought a bar, and the bar that I bought wasn't a little corner bar. It was the bar that I could afford, and it was a black and tan joint at 10808 South Broadway. It was the Polka Dot. And South Broadway is in South Los Angeles, and that, for your geography lesson for today, that's Watts. And I want you to know that we had a going place there. We had every day was a holiday and every meal was a banquet. We had a jazz band and a dance band and a jam band going every day, and it was just the greatest plaything in the world. And I stayed there for about 3.5 years. But then during this period of time, it was some 20 so miles from my house, and the freeways weren't in at that time. So then I would get up there early when I would wake up, and then I would stay late. Virginia was seeing what was happening to the house or to the family, because when I came home, I, like you, I was never or seldom able to make it to the big bed. I was a couch sleeper. And this was 1962 or so. There were absolutely no colored television. There was nothing going on. Certainly not all night movies, all night anything on television. But then I would come in and flop on the couch, the sofa, and everybody else, of course, went to bed. And Virginia would tiptoe out sometime during the middle of the night, in the middle of the morning, 2:30, 3 or 4 o'clock, and turn the television off. You see, if there is anything that will wake an alcoholic up out of a coma, it is quietness. Quietness will awaken any drunk. So when she turned that television off, I would wake up. I'd bolt up. Leave that television alone. Her report would be, Frank, there's nothing on, honey. It's just a test pattern. I would say, that's okay. I'm watching it. So it was her fault. It was her fault. And then at our breakfast conversation one morning, Virginia said, Frank, sell the bar. And I said, Virginia, I can't sell that bar. And I changed the subject and something else. During this period of time, I can see a lot of people that are that were in my bar that were future members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they're the kind of, a lot of you people are got here that way too. Future members of Alcoholics Anonymous are people who had a favorite bar and they drank in it because they knew the owner or the waitress or the bartender or the musicians or the cooks or so, whoever. But then at 2 o'clock when everybody went home, that doesn't mean us, does it? Future members of Alcoholics Anonymous, when 2 o'clock comes, the last call comes, they run to the office, they duck under the booth, they get in the restrooms, and when the door is bolted, the shutters are down, they come out of their hiding places and line up at the bar like turtles on a log. We then start taking inventory. We inventory those poor suckers that had to go home, that didn't have a place to go, they didn't know. So that we were doing that this Friday night, and I had a friend that was opening the club Town Hill at 102nd Main, and I told Bob, when the crowd is over, when the night is over, he opened his place at midnight, when this is when we close the polka dot, I'll bring the crowd over there and we'll start the party. And so then we started over there this Friday night, and the last thing I can remember doing was reaching on the shelf and getting a bottle of scotch. And I thrown my shoulder, my coat over my right shoulder, and the bartender, the manager locked the place up, and there were 10 or 12 of us walking down 108th Street. Now, this will happen tonight in Los Angeles, and it could happen in San Diego, it could happen in Oceanside tonight, but in 1962, this wasn't happening. A car came down 108th Street and fired 3 times. Bang, bang, bang. The next thing I know, I am falling. But you'll be happy to know, because I had that bottle of scotch, I just didn't fall to the ground like that. I just slithered down. I found myself laying on the sidewalk, and I rolled that bottle of scotch across the sidewalk to this fella, because I certainly didn't want to be caught dead with it. I rolled that bottle of scotch across the sidewalk, and I said, take care of this to this fella, and he did. The ambulance came and rushed me to Morningside Emergency Hospital in Englewood, and they x-rayed me, and the slug had gone through my arm and had gone just very neatly in my side and was resting just quietly in the muscle at my spine, just a half inch from my spine, and the doctor came in and showed me the picture. It was a nice-looking picture, too. He told me how fortunate I was. It wasn't a little higher, or just a half inch further. I'd have been paralyzed, and they were going to have to transfer me for surgery, and I said, I'm a retired naval officer. I will go down on the Haven. And he gave me some lip. I said, you can't keep me. Does that sound like a drunk? So then with that, the entourage that had followed the ambulance out to the hospital to see if he was going to go back and salvage his quart of scotch, I guess, they were out there, and I got in the car with them, and we headed back. I didn't head down to the Haven real fast. I went to the club Town Hill. We went right over to that after-hour joint. My arm was wrapped up real neatly, and I had just a little bandage, a little Band-Aid over where the slug went in my side. And I walked in there, and everybody said, here comes Mr. Clean. He's the dude that was hit. And I kind of felt like Sir Galahad coming home from the wars. Kind of felt like a hero. I walked in there and had 3 or 4 tumblers of vodka and then got down on the Haven. And when I got on the Haven, Virginia was down there, and I told Bill, the bartender, don't call her. She won't understand this. And when they were rolling me around on the gurney, lab work and x-rays and stuff, I told Virginia, you leave and you come back this afternoon and bring me a bottle of vodka. Virginia left and she came back and she didn't bring the vodka. I threatened her with her life. Get off this hospital ship and come back tonight. And she came back in the evening and I was all ready for that vodka and she didn't bring it. And when she left, I left too. She went to Studebaker Road and I went right back up to the polka dot. So then I'm not a medical doctor, I am not a pharmacist of any kind, but I cured my gunshot wound. I don't recognize this or recommend this to anybody. I cured that gunshot wound by resting my left arm on top of my bald head and drinking vast quantities of vodka. Now, then that has nothing to do with me being an Alcoholics Anonymous, does it? But then there's not a soul in here that would necessarily call that social drinking. And you see, I knew I couldn't go a day without drinking. And that day when Helen said, we just don't drink a day at a time, you see, I knew I couldn't do it. So the curtain came down. I couldn't have this thing because you don't drink a day at a time. And when she told me that, I had no place to go. There was an Eskimo, and we call them Eskimos, somebody that says something that makes all of the sense in the world in a nonsense world. This guy tapped me on the shoulder, and I don't even know where he came from. He tapped me on the shoulder, and he said, Frank, my sponsor told me that we don't have to stop drinking a day at a time. Man, my antenna went straight up. I wanted to hear what he had to say, because what that old broad was talking about was impossible. And he said that his sponsor had told him, we don't have to stop drinking a day at a time. We just don't take a drink right now. That hit my pygmy brain just right. You see, we learn fast then, don't we? I went over and kicked Virginia under the table and said, let's get your books and get out of here. And on our way out, he asked me if I'd go to a meeting with him that night. And I said, yes, I was agreeable. And we picked up Virginia's books, and as she was driving home, I kind of had them in my lap, and I was thumbing through, and I said, this is a little different anniversary gift. I sure hope she enjoys reading these. When we got home, I had a cupboard full of booze, and I was walking through the house, and I didn't take a drink. That afternoon, I got a call from my eye. I looked out my living room window, and up my sidewalk came a young man taking fast strides, well-dressed, full head of hairs, enough to irritate me anyway. And he had a book in his hand, and he rattled my front door, and he said, my name is Bud, I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous, can I come in? And with that, he was sitting in my chair. And he was crazier than the woman was at Central Office. Because he was telling me, he said, boy, you'll really be happy to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have roundups, and we have powwows, and we have banquets and potlucks, and we drink coffee and eat donuts. I thought, you poor bastard. Here I'm sicker than a billy goat, and you want me to eat a donut. And he asked me if I'd go to a meeting with him that night, and I said, yes. I just knew if I got him out of my house, I wouldn't let him back in. But then our memories are short, and I didn't intend to go with him, but he came by and picked me up, and it was the 17th of August. It was hotter than all get out, and I had asked what I should wear, and I think they said, your jock shorts will be all right. And I took that as meaning a coat and tie and all that stuff, so that when I got in the back seat of his car, and that was mistake number two, he drove up to Signal Hill. There's absolutely nothing in Signal Hill now, and this was 31 years ago, the 17th of August. There was nothing up there then, but then they had this, they met in the basement of the old city hall, the jail, and they had a sign hanging out there with AA, and then they had a light shining on it, and I thought, why don't they turn that light off? Or why don't they take that sign in? Somebody could see you walking in here, and what would they think? You see, when we start coming to our first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, we learn all about anonymity, don't we? You see, I was particularly concerned about, I didn't want anybody to see me walking into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I didn't want them to think that I might be doing something about my drinking or that I might have a problem. Now, I wasn't too concerned probably the day before when I was laying out in the front lawn puking straight up in the air. But when we come to AA, boy, we don't want anybody to know that we ever had a drink. I got in there, and everybody was standing around the coffee pot with everybody talking and nobody listening. And before, this was before styrofoam, they handed me a cup with a handle on it. And before I could say, I don't want any coffee, I had that cup in my hand, and I was as nervous as a good girl in a bad place. I shook that coffee cup absolutely dry, and I wanted to run out of there, bolt out of there right then. But then they went on and they started the meeting, and I was sitting right where this blonde, long-haired, good-looking gentleman is sitting on the second row between my wife and the donut eater. And they started this meeting, and we got as far as the reading tonight. And when the reading was over, I got up and excused myself. I headed to the back of the room, and they had a great big fat coffee maker back there. And I told Frankie that I'm a retired naval officer, and I suffer from claustrophobia. I have a heart condition, a nervous stomach, and what I had to do was go puke. And I did. I went out, and I did an excellent job, and I came back in. They had a sink at the back of the room, as they usually do. And I threw that cold water on my face and up on my bald head, and I dried my head with paper towels, a lint stuck up here. And I went down and told Frankie, you go get my wife and that donut of yours so I can get the hell out of this place. And that was my first meeting, and so you can see I wasn't the first volunteer that we had. As a matter of fact, I have since found out that next week, Alcoholics Anonymous will be 59 years old. And for the benefit of the newcomers, or the people that are just coming to visit once in a while, that we have never, ever had a volunteer for Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody has ever awakened one day and snapped their fingers and said, boy, the world is right with me. I think I'll go down and join AA today. Make no mistake about it. All you've got to do is think of your first meeting and think of how embarrassing it really was. How it was the most embarrassing day of my life. And believe me, I was a chief in the Navy a long time. I did 19 years in the Navy. I did a lot of embarrassing things. But then this was the most humiliating thing it ever did. And when I got home, this is something that I shall never forget. I didn't take a drink when I got home. And I didn't take a drink for the next 35 days, and I went to a meeting every day. I went to the meeting as the meeting started, alone, and as soon as they said the Our Father, I would turn, and we weren't holding hands then, so I didn't have to break away from anybody. As soon as they said the Our Father, I would get out, and I'd hit the road, and I can remember walking from East Bay or East Side Open Door Meeting, and if they met in the basement, and I can remember looking skyward and saying, well, nothing happened tonight. I don't know what I expected to happen. But I can remember leaving a bar and telling whoever I was sitting with at the bar, well, I've got an appointment, I'm going to leave, and are you coming back? I don't know. But I always had hopes that I wouldn't have to come back. And then that first 35 days, I didn't go to the bars except just to go in and buy a round of drinks, you know, and let those people tell me how good I looked. Because they'd say, boy, I wish I had your willpower, and I'd always bring myself up to full attention. And I'd say, yes, some of us have and some haven't. You know, some of us can straighten up our lives, and with that I'd leave. So then this on about the 35th or 36th or 37th day, I left my home group and went up to the Eldorado. I left the meeting at 10 o'clock and headed up to Spring and Studebaker Road, and I went in there, and they said, here comes the Reverend. I'd been so clean living that they had nicknamed me this, and I said, the Reverend is drinking tonight. And you see, I had this planned. It wasn't a slip. I don't believe in slips, but then this was a slip if there ever was one. I had a 35-day premeditated drunk because I was going to drink that Friday night and Saturday night, and on Sunday I was going to quit drinking. I'd done it once before. I'd quit drinking on the 17th of August, so I knew how. And I went up there, and you know that Friday and Saturday went fine. Sunday, the day I was going to quit drinking, the wheels came off. Because I was sitting there drinking with Bowtie Sid, the manager of Ralph's Market, and Bowtie Sid and I'd gone, we'd drunk tons of booze, and we'd gone to the racetrack together, and we're a very good dear friend, and both of us were still drinking, and that afternoon I told Sid, well, I'm going down to East Bay to an AA meeting. He said, I'm not going to them AA meetings, sir. I'm not going to their meetings, and before long, you know who went with me. Sid went with me, but we were late, and we went in after drinking, and I'm sure that we knocked over some chairs and pushed tables around and just created a, a general commotion, as most wet drunks do when they come in. And we were talking, carrying on our own conversation. Everybody in the room was looking back to see who was causing this. And I was trying to ignore Sid. He started coughing. And somebody finally gave him a drink of water. I wanted him to fall dead because everybody in that place was looking at him. On our way out, when the meeting was over, Sid said, "Honeycutt, I'm not going to any more of them A&A meetings with you." And I said, "You can bet your sweet ass on that, man. You make a spectacle of yourself." I'd like to report that about 7 or 8 years later, Sid came in, and the last time I saw Sid, he was sober. But then that was the night, and I went out, and that started the only hell that I know I'll ever know. Because then I would go to a meeting every day, and I had to drink. If you understand that, you understand it. And if you don't understand that, I could talk to you forever and never convince you. You see, when we drink and we don't want to drink, most alcoholics that have been here and have heard what we have, and if you've attended 35 meetings in a row, you know that this is something that we need and that we can have it. But then when you go out and start drinking again to try to get sober, I couldn't do it. I would go to a meeting every day, and I prayed, and I read the book, and I picked up people. I did whatever they wanted me to do. I even stayed later, but then I had to drink. My daughter was 14 years of age. I was talking with somebody tonight about this. I missed my children growing up. Dick was 8 when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and my daughter was 14, and they had never seen their dad go a day without drinking. I'd been married to their mother for that 19 years, and she had never seen me a day without drinking some, because it was just that necessary. So that Kathy asked me this one morning, and it was long after I had sold the bar. It was long after I'd sold the bar and had gone back into real estate. Kathy had asked me this one morning, she said, "Dad, please don't drink today." And I told Kathy immediately, "Well, I won't, Dob." And you see, I meant it. Alcoholics mean things when they have loved ones ask you a question or ask you to do something, we mean it. So then Kathy extracted from me another promise. She said, "Dad, would you say that on the Bible?" You see, I'd obviously lied to her before, and we didn't talk on the Bible. We didn't say things on the Bible. But that morning, it seemed that there was a father-daughter banquet that night. And Kathy wanted her dad to take her. And she turned on her heel and went into the bedroom and brought back a Bible. And I looked down in her eyes. She was a little girl, a tow-headed girl that stood 4 feet 9 inches tall. And I loved her with my heart and soul. Kathy had, up until that time, 16 or 17 major surgeries on her hips and cervical spine and everything else, and I love that child so much. Every alcoholic loves their children, but if they have one that has been afflicted and needs them especially, we really need them. We really love them. And there was nothing that I wouldn't have done for Kathy. But then she went in and got that Bible, and I held the Bible in my right hand and looked down in her eyes, and I said, "I won't drink today, Doc." And Kathy smiled up through tears with a reddened face, and she turned and walked into the bathroom, and she washed her face and walked off to school. My real estate office was located on the west side of Long Beach, and when I left to go to work that morning, I usually had to do some banking, and I stopped by the bank. Probably an hour later, and when I pulled behind the Security Pacific Bank on Los Coyotes Diagonal, I parked in a parking place at the back of the bank as I usually did, and I got out of the car and started walking to the bank. And then I remembered that I had a bottle of vodka under the seat, and I turned around and went back and got into the car and raised the seat and drank that bottle of vodka. And when I did, I looked at the bottle, and then I called myself all of the dirty words that only you and I can call ourselves. When we've broken a promise to the person we love more than anything in the world, that there was nothing that I could do, and I don't know what happened to Kathy's banquet that day. You see, I'm an alcoholic, and when I started drinking, I lost control. I had no control. I kept going to meetings, and that wasn't the last day that I drank. But the day before Easter, 1964, was not too far down the way, and I had been out on another one of my safaris, and I came in that Saturday morning, and Virginia had Kathy and Dick in her car, and she was driving away, and I stopped her. I pulled behind her, and I stopped her, and Virginia, I got out of the car and walked to her window, and I said, "Honey, you don't have to leave because I'm not going to drink this weekend." You see, every time that Chuck would talk, from the time I had started listening to him in August or September 1963 until the following March, Chuck would be going somewhere, and he talked practically 4, 5, or 6 times a week. And wherever Chuck would go, I would be sitting on the front row. And I would ask him tonight, "Where are you going next?" And wherever it was, I'd get in my car, and a fellow that worked for me, he and I would go. And I would always attend Chuck's meetings. As a matter of fact, Chuck, one time before this came about, Chuck, I was following Chuck around, and I would always line up and tell Chuck how much I enjoyed his talk and how much good I had gotten out of it. And I'm sure that Chuck had gotten tired of me blowing that non-smelling vodka on him. And he gave me the shoulder treatment this one night, and it's as if he's come down from heaven to do it to me now, because he was pounding on my left shoulder and looking down in my eyes. And he said, "Frank, this program is going to work a lot better for you when you stop drinking." Just as crazy as the rest of those people. If I could stop drinking, you wouldn't catch me dead in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I did not tell him that. I didn't tell him that. That's what I thought. But then that was what Chuck always then said. Between every two drunks, I get as sober as I am right now. Chuck had become a periodic, and periodics just don't get drunk real fast. They kind of wean themselves into a drunk to where they can't get up, and then they wean themselves off. So that he walked and froze and died. In his tapes, he said he'd walk and freeze and die. So then I'd heard him say that, and when Virginia said that that she hoped that tomorrow I would be able to come up and have Easter dinner with the family as she drove away to Glendale, then I walked into my house, and I had heard what Chuck had said, and I started walking through my house. Obviously, nobody was there, and I started walking through the house, and I found myself kneeling at the foot of my bed. And I hadn't planned this, because alcoholics, when you're doing something this momentous, if you plan ahead, you're going to get an audience, aren't we? I hadn't planned it, because there's nobody there, and I was kneeling at the foot of my bed, and I said a prayer along this line. "God, you know I have been going to those meetings. If you will help me to get sober, I'll do whatever I can for Alcoholics Anonymous." That was the 28th day of March, 1964, and until today I haven't had to take a drink. That's 11,016 days ago. And when they called up Chips to come get a chip, they didn't have one for that amount. Am I supposed to quit now? Okay, that's right. Well, I'll tell you what. This program works, and it works 100% of the time, all of the time. When you leave here, there'll be some people that'll leave here and go drink again. I want to save you some more embarrassment, along with the embarrassment I'm going to save you with that test that you're going to take. That don't tell people when you start drinking, "Well, I've been to that A&A because it don't work." Because you see, society knows that it does work. In all probability, the guy or gal that you're telling it to probably has 10 and a half or 11 years. So then I thank you. I thank Debbie for asking me to come down here. And this program works. This program works all of the time. All of the time. You have to do it. That little girl that I was telling you about, Kathy died 11 years ago. She died of a brain tumor. But because I had met you and had been doing what you told me to do. You see, Kathy saw her dad walk on the sunny side of the street for 19 years. We had the greatest love affair in the world. And you see, I would have missed every day of that if I hadn't met you. God bless you.
Says there will be a short question and answer period, and if you have a question, please raise your hand and ask and wait to be called on. Okay.
Thank you, dear. Okay, let's have it loud and clear. Mark.
How many of those 20 questions did you answer?
I was lying. I only answered 11 or 12 yeses. Okay. God, I hate to come down here and cure all of this alcoholism with this. I would like to come back down one day. Don?
I'm Don, an alcoholic. Did you ever have the bullet taken out?
No. He asked if I ever had the bullet taken out. I had some bronchial trouble in Hawaii last October. And I had forgotten about this, and we went in to take some x-rays, and the nurse come hustling out of the dark room and said, "What's this?" Well, it was the bullet. But it's still sitting there. The doctors at the time said it would be far more dangerous to remove the slug than it would be to leave it there. So then the next time you're shot, just leave it there. Yes, sir.
The time when you got down on your knees talking, I didn't say I'm not
talking. Ed.
The time you got down on your knees to talk to God, is that the first time or did you have prior dealings with God?
Ed asked if that was the first time that I had gotten down on my knees. I had been on my knees an awful lot of times. I had done all of these things. I had done everything that had been done. But that particular morning, I know that I didn't want to stop drinking any more the 28th day of March than I probably had the January the 21st. But then that day, it seemed that I had done enough or that the help was there. So that if you pray once and it doesn't work, what does it tell us to do? Just to keep praying. That every prayer is answered. Every prayer is answered. Gotta be some more. Tell me where I was wrong.